Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oh, for the days when the markets were just about stocks and commodities. A share of this, a barrel of that, how simple it was. Now you can trade almost anything you like, which is kind of how we got into this mess, isn't it? New rules for the trading road today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. Online at elance.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 4th of June. Good to have you here. And to paraphrase Benjamin Franklin, if I might, I think we can safely add new financial regulations to death and taxes on the list of things we know are coming. Both Congress and the White House have promised as much, especially for the largely unregulated but huge, on the order of trillions of dollars, market for what are known as derivatives. That's almost anything that's not a straight stock or a commodity. Credit default swaps and AIG are a great example of derivatives gone horribly wrong. Today, the head regulator for the futures trading industry proposed some new rules. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports that that has prompted some worries about regulatory overreach.
Companies use derivatives contracts as insurance against dramatic swings in the prices of commodities, say flour or oil. But with no oversight, these contracts became a new form of speculation, as investors bet on everything from real estate prices to interest rates. At a Senate hearing today, the new chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Gary Gensler, said it's time to impose some rules.
Such reforms must comprehensively regulate both the derivative dealers, those institutions that make markets in these products, as well as regulating the markets themselves.
Gensler wants all derivatives trading to go through a clearinghouse. Essentially, trades would be supervised, and the banks and other financial institutions that trade the contracts would have to put up capital to guarantee payments. Financial institutions don't like that idea. They say posting collateral would eat away their profits, and they say a regulated exchange would eliminate flexibility. Mark Lenzowski is a managing director at JP Morgan Chase.
We think it would be a mistake to impose that kind of a one-size-fits-all requirement on our economy.
But after today's hearing, Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, who backs regulation, said he still wants derivatives trading out in the open so everyone can see their value.
Price discovery is important, and that's why I still come back to this idea of putting these on a regulated exchange.
Senator Harkin expects Congress to move on derivatives regulations in the fall. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Airlines have been suffering as much as anybody in this recession, and United is no exception. Its share price has fallen about 85% since it got out of bankruptcy in 2006. So it was a bit of a surprise this morning when United said it's going to order 150 new planes to replace the ones it currently has. Ashley Milne-Tite reports the airline seems to be doing a little recession bargain hunting.
Boeing and Airbus have had a difficult couple of years. They've both had customers cancel or put off orders recently. Daryl Jenkins is an airline consultant. He says the plane makers will fight hard for United's business.
This will probably be the biggest single plane order for the next 2 or 3 years.
And United's in a perfect position to get a great deal. Michael Boyd runs Boyd Group International.
It's not beyond comprehension that they might have Airbus in one room, Boeing in another room, and just shuttle offers back and forth until one gets fed up and leaves the building. So it will be very, very tough negotiating.
So tough that United should be able to obtain attractive terms not just on the price of the planes, but on the financing package to buy them.
The manufacturer will have some financial institutions lined up. The manufacturer also goes to suppliers. Like the people who make the brakes, the people who make the engines, and say, you come to the financing party, because later on you'll be selling parts to this airline.
The decision to order new planes could help United in other ways. Consultant Daryl Jenkins says it comes just as the company is addressing its difficult relationship with its employees.
Pilots make different amounts of money flying different planes. So this could indeed be a bargaining chip in a labor negotiation. Certainly the relationship in United between pilots and management is not good.
Management and staff are thrashing out new labor agreements right now. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
I don't know about you, but by far the biggest check my wife and I wrote this year was to the Internal Revenue Service. I'll spare you the details, but I'd bet my experience isn't unique. For a lot of us, paying taxes is one of our larger transactions, which is why it's disquieting to learn that most paid tax preparers out there are unlicensed and completely unregulated. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
If you walk into the office of a big chain that prepares taxes, chances are you're not going to sit down across from a CPA, a tax attorney, or even a licensed tax preparer.
Most of the paid preparers that would be in storefronts, for instance, during the tax season, are not regulated by anyone.
Michael Brostek works at the Government Accountability Office. Brooke Millington runs her own tax preparation firm.
But to do what you're doing now, you didn't, and to start your business, you didn't have to pass any tests.
No, I could have just opened up a storefront and said, I'll do your tax. I could have done it from my home. I could have set up a booth on the street.
Millington says the quality of some tax services out there is atrocious.
I hear a lot of stories.
Brostek was hearing stories, too. So the GAO went undercover to test the accuracy of tax preparation services. They went into 19 storefronts and...
Everybody made at least one error.
Some made big ones worth thousands of dollars.
I think this is incredibly important.
Doug Schulman runs the IRS.
When people pay good money, they shouldn't get bad advice.
So Schulman told members of Congress today that the IRS is going to propose new standards for tax preparers by the end of the year. Brostek at the GAO says in Oregon, preparers already have to take a simple test before they can set up shop. He says returns there are more accurate, and that saves the feds roughly $390 million a year in that state alone. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a slow but steady climb up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The latest entry in the smartphone wars goes on sale this weekend under the catchy name of the Palm Pre. Pre what, though, is a fair question, since Palm is actually playing catch-up. This phone is a must-win for Palm. The company has gone from digital darling to afterthought in just a couple of short years. Early reviews say the Pre is supposed to be pretty good, but how's it going to play against the iPhone? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith gives us the 411.
Isn't it beautiful when life simply flows together? Introducing... the Palm Pre.
A few hundred dollars and a two-year contract with Sprint will need to flow together if you want to get your hands on the new Palm Pre. It has high-speed internet, GPS, a digital camera with flash, and a first for smartphones, a touchscreen, and a keyboard. CNET editor Bonnie Cha has tried out the Pre.
The multitasking capabilities, I think they've set a new standard for that, and the display is just really vibrant and amazing, and I think it's better than the iPhones.
Display's important, but these days, it's all about the apps. You know, those software applications that let you pop virtual bubble wrap or find a bathroom in New York? The iPhone has more than 35,000 apps. The Pre, about a dozen for now. Industry analyst Jeff Kagan says Palm has to deliver on that front. He points out Palm invented the PDA. Remember the Palm Pilot? Yeah.
Palm, which basically cornered the smartphone market, is now just trying to get some attention. And now, this new device. It's supposed to breathe new life into its lungs.
Palm may have an edge. It costs the same as an iPhone, but Palm's contract with Sprint is roughly $20 a month cheaper than iPhone's AT&T contract. Mark Donovan is an analyst for ComScore.
One decision, I think, is going to be price point for people. I think price, certainly in this economy, is an important factor.
That hasn't been lost on Apple. It's expected to announce a new iPhone on Monday, and it could come with a lower price. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Industry conventions aren't usually the most dynamic of affairs. Bland conference rooms and stale speakers come to mind. But just down the street from Marketplace World headquarters here in Los Angeles, there is something entirely different going on. The Electronics Entertainment Expo wraps up today.
Yeah! This is gonna hurt.
Huge digital displays dwarf the thousands of people walking the floor. Costumed characters mingle with retail executives. Video games of all descriptions are everywhere, which is why yesterday morning I went to meet up with our technology guy, Kevin Pereira from G4 Television.
Welcome to E3, Kai.
Tell us where we are, what this place is.
We're at the Electronic Entertainment Expo, which is sort of like Nerd Prom, yes. If you will. It's the Geek Super Bowl. It's all the big developers and game producers and creators and manufacturers. They get together at the convention center. Crowds from 40,000 to 60,000 in attendance, checking out all the latest in digital entertainment.
It looks like people are walking around playing video games, basically.
That's exactly, yes. That's the one-sentence description of what's happening.
Just thought I'd wrap it up.
No, there's actually a lot of business being done here. In addition to showing off the games to casual consumers and whatnot, this is where Best Buy will send their head retailers to come and figure out which titles they're going to order, how many thousands of copies they're going to order, which peripherals they want to get on store shelves. So there's a lot of actual business transactions taking place in between people dressed as cows with giant animatronic udders at the Natsume booth.
What is hot this year then? What are we going to see come Christmas?
Well, come Christmas, we're going to see more of the same. We're going to see bigger and better exclusive titles for all these consoles.
So it's the Wii and the Xbox and all that?
Correct. PlayStation 3, Wii, Xbox 360. You're just going to see bigger and better games for it now that the developers have figured out how the hardware works. Next year, in the coming years, you're going to see new ways to actually experience those games.
So there is, for want of a better phrase, a killer app here, right?
There's
new technologies coming
out. Yeah, it's getting rid of the controller. Game developers, and you know, Nintendo was first to figure out that a controller for many is a barrier to entry. I could put the controller in my mother's hand, and she will ask what these buttons do and probably gnaw on them confused.
Same here.
And that'll be that. It's my mom. But when you get rid of that controller and you tell somebody, just stand in front of the television and a webcam is going to turn your body into the controller, which is Microsoft's approach, that just works. And so they demoed a thing called Project Natal, which literally turns your body into a virtual skeleton on the screen, and you can then control your game. If you want to race, put your arms in front of you and move it around. Do you want to interact with a character? Well, if you break eye contact, the character's going to ask you why you're looking away from him. It's these kind of experiences that we're going to see unfolding over the next few years that are going to change the way the games industry is viewed and approached by so many people.
Is that going to widen the audience?
Absolutely. I mean, the controller for most is a huge barrier to entry, and they know that. So, you know, Nintendo did a great job of getting my parents and my grandparents interested in playing tennis on the TV. Then they came out with the Wii Fit, which got people interested in fitness. Sony and Microsoft, they took note. They said, we have these giant consoles in households that are so powerful. How can we take advantage of that? And so they're each trying their own different approach into making your body the game controller. So now anybody can literally get up off the couch and just play.
Have none of these companies that are here and the people who are coming to buy for the big corporations, have none of them heard that there's a recession on?
No, they haven't, in case you didn't.
I mean, it's crazy.
I mean, look, last year E3 scaled back and was in Santa Monica at the Barker Hangar, and we're talking, it was 4,000 people. And they said, this is bad for the industry because it makes us look small at a time where every industry is weak. So they said, let's come back. Let's do it at the convention center. Let's spend millions of dollars. Let's put on press conferences and have karaoke parties and do the big press blitzes. And it's working. And that's because they know that even in a recession, games do well. Why is that? Well, because you can spend $4 on a casual gaming experience online. You don't have to even leave your house. Or you can go out and spend $60, which sounds like a huge investment, but gamers know that they can get 60 to 80 to 120 hours of gameplay out of that. So your return on investment there is incredible, especially if it's online.
Kevin Pereira, G4 Television, broadcasting live here, I should say.
23 hours.
Yeah, which is why he sounds a little raspy. Kevin, thanks a bunch.
My apologies, but thank you.
Coming up, too many people out of work, not enough money out there.
We were paying out roughly $5 million a week, and suddenly it jumped to $10 million a week in benefits. And the more we paid out, the less money we had in our trust fund.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 0.8% today, 74 points, closed at 8,750. The NASDAQ picked up 1.3%, 24 points, ended at 1,850. The S&P 500 climbed 1.1%, that is 10 points, finished at 942. Financial stocks did the heavy lifting after several analysts recommended that investors buy bank shares. Yes, I did say buy bank shares. Citigroup, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs all charged up more than 5% today. JPMorgan Chase tacked on 4%. No love today for retail, though. Same-store sales took an unexpectedly large step down in May as consumers took their money to the, well, to the bank. Macy's unpacked 3.33%. Nordstrom marked down its shares by nearly 7%. Walmart was also down a smidge. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. The Labor Department gives us unemployment numbers for May. The Federal Reserve reports on how much money creditors extended to consumers in April. And has word gotten around your office that tomorrow is National Donut Day? It was established in 1938 as a fundraiser for the Chicago Salvation Army to help those in need during the Great Depression. Eat a donut. Go to the gym. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama was in Cairo today, where he gave a much-anticipated speech about America's relationship with the Middle East. A little more than a year ago, Marketplace was in Cairo as well for a series that we call The Middle East at Work. A lot of things in that part of the world have changed since then with an international recession. But one thing in particular has not: the problems presented by huge numbers of chronically unemployed young people. Navtej Dhillon is the director of the Middle East Youth Initiative at the Brookings Institution, and he points out that 60% of the people who live in that region are less than 30 years old. In Cairo alone, he told me, there are 1.5 million young people out of work and another million entering the labor market at a time when the global economy is in shreds.
So you have a peaking youth population and you have a slumping economy. The combination of the two is particularly bad. You know, imagine a typical Middle Eastern family where there are two parents and three young adults. The two parents are retiring, and unfortunately the three young adults who should be working, they are not working, and they're living with their parents because they have no jobs, they can't get married, they don't have access to housing, they have no savings, and therefore they're really not able to contribute to the economy of the nation as well as the economy of the household.
And then there becomes eventually a political and a social problem with this as well, as you have these 20-somethings who still live with their parents.
Certainly. I think that unemployment early on in one's career can have lifelong impacts in terms of reduced earnings. It can lead to a sense of alienation within society. But I would say the stakes are even larger. Imagine the baby boomers growing up in the Great Depression. Because they were able to grow up at a time of relative prosperity in the U.S., they were able to both contribute to that prosperity and maximize it. I think in the Middle East, this generation hasn't had that opportunity. So, you know, will this generation be better off than their parents? And if not, then that regressive trend, I think, really imperils the prosperity of the Middle East and its place in the global economy.
You mentioned Egypt and some of the problems it's having. Are there countries in the region, either in the Gulf region or elsewhere in the Middle East, that are doing this well, that are managing this problem?
The good news here is that many countries have made tremendous investments in health and education. So you have young people who are more educated and healthier than their parents. But I would argue that it's really hard to point to a single country where we have achieved success. I think this problem has been a challenge for almost all countries, and it has been in the past. It's the challenge of the moment, and it will be the challenge of the future.
Is there something that a Middle Eastern government can do? I mean, what are the steps that they ought to be taking as they try to solve this problem?
I think that they also need to be investing in new sectors, particularly the social sector, I would argue. The Middle East needs more qualified teachers, social workers, nurses. These are all areas that can be invested in to create opportunities. And of course, I think there needs to be a larger reform agenda where business costs are reduced, deregulation is promoted in certain areas so that greater private investment can come to the region that can lead to creation of more jobs. And of course, I think that there also needs to be just a more of a dialogue between the citizens and the states about where the Middle East is currently at and really realigning the expectations of the citizens.
What about a stimulus plan? Are they considering that? Would that work?
Some countries certainly are. I think there are countries that have large amounts of money as a result of the oil boom in the last 6-7 years. Countries like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait certainly have the resources to pursue stimulus packages, and some of them have been. On the other extreme, there are vulnerable countries which do not have the resources, such as Yemen, but are also being hit by the economic crisis that are going to need assistance.
If this generation, the current young generation over there, is lost, is not given these opportunities, then what happens to their kids and the kids after that?
I think that it heightens the possibility of greater poverty, social discontent, and I would argue that in places such as West Bank and Gaza and Yemen, parts of Lebanon which have experienced conflict, it also, I think, makes the efforts of peace building much harder.
Navtej Dhillon at the Brookings Institution. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
By this time tomorrow, there's a pretty good chance the unemployment rate is going to be somewhere north of 9%. We'll get the details from the Labor Department in the morning, along with the actual number of jobs the economy lost last month. People that get laid off are supposed to have a safety net to help tide them over after they're put out of work. But unemployment insurance isn't working that way in this recession. There are so many Americans getting jobless benefits that a lot of state trust funds are going broke, or they're heading that way. In collaboration with the investigative newsroom ProPublica, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the final part of our series on unequal unemployment.
Anybody on this line filing for the first time? Anyone just looking for work?
It's a busy Tuesday morning at South Carolina's one-stop employment center in Columbia. Though to tell the truth, it's been pretty busy ever since the economy turned bad. I'm here to meet Jimmy Jones of the state's Employment Security Commission. Jones says the problem started 18 months ago.
When we were paying out roughly $5 million a week, and suddenly it jumped to $10 million a week in benefits. And the more we paid out, the less money we had in our trust fund.
In fact, they drained the trust fund dry. Since January, the states had to borrow from the federal government to keep paying benefits. This rapid descent into insolvency is the talk of the capital. People in Columbia want to know who to blame and how to pay the bill.
We are currently at $300 million that we've already borrowed from the federal government.
Kenny Bingham is Republican majority leader of the South Carolina House. He says the debt could hit a billion by the end of the year.
That money has to be paid back, and it's going to be paid back by the businesses of the state of South Carolina. I don't know whenever we've had a billion-dollar tax increase, but we're fixing to have that.
So why is this on the backs of employers? Well, employers pay the taxes that fund unemployment insurance. States set the tax rates, and lawmakers are often under pressure from business to keep those taxes low. And that's just what happened here. Remember the ants and grasshoppers fable? South Carolina is a grasshopper. It failed to save for an economic winter. Back in 2000, its trust fund was more than $800 million in the black. Business leaders worried that money, money collected from employers, would be diverted to pay for other state programs. So the legislature cut taxes, and the unemployment fund headed down, down, down. To be fair, there are lots of grasshoppers out there. Indiana, California, New York, they're all deep in debt. Like South Carolina, many only tax the first $7,000 in wages, a level set decades ago. The state of Oregon taxes the first $31,000 in income. It's the ant in our fable.
Right now, we have about $1.4 billion in our fund.
Tim Nesbitt is deputy chief of staff to the Oregon governor.
That means that we can continue to pay benefits for another year at this rate.
So Oregon's in fine shape, even though it has a 12% unemployment rate, which is worse than South Carolina's. Plus, ever ant-ish, when times are good, Oregon increases taxes automatically, filling the trust fund. That way, taxes on business can actually be lowered in times like these when more people are hitting the unemployment lines. And there's plenty of pain to go around right now. Oregon is facing huge budget cuts to programs like health care and education, and advocates have been out at the Capitol building in Salem protesting.
Enough is enough. And if we eliminate the school for the blind and opportunities,
but unemployed people aren't facing any cuts right now. In fact, the huge surplus in the unemployment trust fund is a juicy target for politicians. The governor wants to tap it to provide emergency summer jobs for the unemployed. Business leaders don't like the idea. J.L. Wilson of Associated Oregon Industries says this is employers' money and it comes at a cost.
There's a lot of grumbling about the expense of the state's unemployment system, but you know, on the flip side, you have to look at our fund is relatively well managed and quite simply, it's not broke.
That's our cue back to South Carolina, which is broke and getting broker. The state's troubles may make it harder for people like Chlorine Jones. I met her in Greenville, an old industrial town. Like many I talk to, she's finding it takes longer to land steady work in the textile mills. She's been laid off twice in the last year.
Well, I'd worked for the same company, but the other plant that I worked for, it closed down. And then I went to work for one of their other companies, and it closed down too.
South Carolina's leaders, meanwhile, are sparring over how to save the system and pay down its mounting debt. Everyone agrees business will have to pay higher taxes eventually. But before that happens, the unemployed are likely to see their benefits cut. And legislators are demanding that people who've been fired for misconduct, things like drinking on the job or stealing from the boss, be kicked off the rolls.
We have to contact your employer, make sure it was a layoff and all that.
Back at the Employment Security Commission in Columbia, Jimmy Jones says the state will have to do something, and soon.
We have talked about increasing the disqualifications of people who were discharged. We do not deduct for Social Security, which could be done.
That means people's unemployment checks would be reduced by the amount they receive in Social Security benefits. And mill worker Chlorine Jones, well, she's in her 70s and on Social Security, so she'd be getting even less than she does right now to live on from the state of South Carolina. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Thanks to Olga Pierce at ProPublica for her work on this story. To find out whether your state has anything left in its unemployment account, ProPublica has put together an interactive map. There's a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, and a name you'll recognize from the earliest days of the subprime mess, before it became a full-blown financial crisis and a recession, too. The Securities and Exchange Commission charged former Countrywide CEO Angela Mazzillo and two other executives with securities fraud today. Mazzillo got hit with charges of insider trading as well. The SEC says Mazzillo took $140 million in stock sales out of that company, knowing all the while that it and the industry were about to blow up horribly. No word from Bank of America, which bought Countrywide for $2.5 billion last July. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow bumped up 74 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ grabbed 24 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 took back 10 points. That is 1.1% there. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time, regulation, regulation, and regulation. Oh, and whether the economic recovery has been trampled. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.